So, how many people are from the public health world? Raise your hand if you're from the public health world. Yeah. And how many are like foodies, food and nutrition people in the public health world? So, how many people are from government, whether you're in public health or not? How many people are from the food industry? All right, brave, brave to identify yourself. And that's great. How many people thought, that, okay, this is kind of like the Obama-Romney debate, that Deb won the debate. And it only if you get clear, like, okay. How many people feel Dr. Sturm won the debate? How many people feel that both people made good points, that we should have an Obama-Romney ticket? Who feels like we should have an Obama? No. Bad idea. All right. So I'm the government here. I'm the government voice. And what does government have to do? Government has to take into account all these competing interests. And I've never been known to myself as I've been always a very opinionated, argumentative person. But I've been working in government for a long time now as a regulator in a city known to be very, to be a very sort of a fertile place to plant crazy regulations and see how they go. So I had a lot of experience, and I'm going to try to bring that experience to this problem and hopefully disguise how I really feel about all this. Those are really good points on both sides. And I think that, scientifically, we don't know how to control our behaviors. In the face of, overwhelming food desire, we're helpless. And but as true as that might be, it's a terrible argument to take out there. You're not going to win the argument, even if it's true. You're not going to win the argument with people, because who's going to say, yeah, I'm meek and I can't make up my own decisions? I mean, no one's going to, or it's going to take a lot of evolution of human beings to be able to sort of acknowledge that degree of that sort of reality about themselves. So I'm going to cover a few issues and around the idea of government food regulation of the away from home setting. And I'm going to, this is how I might approach it as a regulator. Is there a social need? Is there an important problem? And is this a good, effective solution to that problem? Is there a precedent for this kind of solution? Is there a history of doing something similar that I can point to? Is it feasible to implement? Will it work? Can I actually do this? And that's mostly sort of cost and those type. Is it politically viable, which is another type of feasibility? Are there unintended consequences? And are there alternatives? Because if there's an alternative with less consequences that may meet these criteria better, let's do that. So Deborah covered the social need. And I think that there's no question that we're confronted with a pretty large problem, and I'll view it a little. I mean, she's got the details up there, but I'll view it in much more macro terms. We, and I think you guys know the answer more precisely, we overproduce food energy relative to our needs. We waste a lot, but we overconsume because we overproduce. And those overproducers, they have a market interest in getting us to purchase the food. So the food all has to be bought, right? And some of it can be wasted, but there it is sitting in front of us. And there's really the root. Can we reduce the overproduction? I think the answer is in reducing the overproduction of food energy through creative means, but I'm not sure how to do that exactly. But so this is when we're talking about restaurant regulation. These are the kinds of things that we're talking about imposing as standards. So, and I should have put in this kind of as one of the steps, because when we're talking about the regulation as an idea, we have to translate it into clear criteria that we put into regulation. And so these might be some of the things that we would say. So meals and menu items have to meet certain nutrient and meal component standards. They have to have no more or no less than a certain amount of calories, fat, sodium, fiber, vegetable, fruit, et cetera. We could have mandates for every portion. There should be a standard portion size or a maximum portion size or a minimum portion size. Remember, hunger is a food issue, right? Hunger is arguably as important as obesity, and we don't want hunger. So reduced portion sizes, limiting beverages size. So that's what New York has proposed, limiting refills, limiting the types of beverages to sugar-free beverages, low-fat or fat-free milk as default choices, menu offerings for fruits and vegetables, a certain minimum number of them. These criteria actually are ones that have emerged from a national sort of expert consensus dialogue about what kinds of standards would be potentially feasible to impose in restaurants, and these were some of the ideas that came out of the group, and I'm reflecting them there. There's a lot more detail if you're interested. So regulatory precedents. Has this ever been done before? And or how do we regulate food? And how close or how far can we say, oh, we regulate things, so we should regulate this? I mean, how does that analogy hold? Is there really a precedent? Well, I think you can kind of be the judge here. So we have food safety laws. These are intended to address adulterants, contaminants, microbes, and that are involuntary and unrecognizable hazards. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about regulations and when regulations tip a threshold for people agreeing that, yes, we need to act together to protect ourselves collectively. And one of the key criteria of a regulation, on the demand side of a regulation, if there's an involuntary hazard, right? You're in an airplane. If the airplane isn't regulated, and, you know, the design, it's not fly, it may crash into something else or, you know, not do something. You have no control on it. So that's a high, like, you know, people want that thing regulated, you know, very strongly. If you're in control of something, there's less demand for regulation, arguably. And I think that's where our tough problem comes from in this case. Unrecognizable hazards. If you can see the hazard, then arguably, you can make a choice, arguably you're in control, which will diminish, I think, the demand for the regulation. You can look at the U.S. school food nutrition standards. We've done it already. So if anyone says, no, we cannot impose food standards on meals, no, we've done it. We've done it for 90,000 school districts in the country. I think 90,000 school districts. But what's the difference here? Well, we've imposed a regulation on ourselves. We're paying for the food so we can regulate it. We can set the standard. So kind of, sort of, it's proof of feasibility, but not necessarily a strong precedent for private sector regulation. Retail food labeling. Okay, we did it, right? But the argument here was a consumer right to know. The strong argument, there wasn't a evidence-based, no matter what anyone said, there wasn't an evidence-based that this was effective as a nutritional intervention or a calorie intervention or whatever. The argument that carried the day, that this was simple to do and it was a right-to-know law. People should know what's in the food. The trans-fat ban in California, this was an isolated, and we banned trans-fat. New York banned trans-fat. We banned trans-fat California-wide. It was an easy one. It was an isolated, who is, you know, people for trans fat. There was no people for trans fat, right? And it was an isolated, harmful micronutrient with alternatives. Any other fats we could use? Sure, right? You know, peanut oil, whatever. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if that's actually not the right analogy, sorry, but you didn't need the trans fats. You could think of alternative mechanisms. So, feasibility. So thinking about feasibility, and I think about this because if Deborah won, you know, Roland keeps breaking things and can't keep coming to conferences, eventually she's going to win, right? Because he's not going to, you know, she's going to be the people they count on. Then I would have to do it, right? I'm the regulator. I'm the one who's going to have to make sure that menu labeling is out there. I have to make sure that our silly toy ordinance is working in San Francisco. So the regulatory, so there's some good news here for the pro side. The regulatory infrastructure exists. We go to every restaurant and make sure that food is safe. That very nice costs are borne by businesses. Okay? It may make political feasibility more difficult, but there's a mechanism to recoup the costs. The standards are achievable. I think of the things that we looked at above here, these are achievable. These are doable. These are not, you know, we do much more difficult things. Beyond doable, can my inspector, when they go out there, easily test compliance? Can you look, and I think for many of those things, they're things you might see on a menu, right? Can you, if you combine these with labeling, and if it was a healthy meal, it would have to be, by law, you'd have to provide the micronutrients. But I think here, we're a little less certain. When we look at those criteria, we may have to very carefully say, what would we monitor? What would that inspector monitor in order to make it work, in order to be able to see it? Because if you impose very high monitoring costs, if it's not measurable, or I have to go do some complicated test, or it takes trouble, you know what's going to happen? The inspectors are not going to do it. That's actually what's going to happen. So we have to, but you can, this is about balancing, figuring out the criteria and the monitoring that works together. So, our biggest problem, the political environment. Well, on one hand, there's consumer demand for healthier food choices. But where is regulation right now, food regulation, on the national public policy agenda? So it should have been in the first debate, right? I did go away for a little bit to get something to eat. Did I miss it?
No.
No, I didn't miss it. I didn't see it. I didn't see it come up as a foreign policy issue either, and I didn't see it as a question from the public. What does that tell us? Okay, where is it on the public health agenda? Where is it on the public health agenda? This room is one of the biggest, fullest rooms in the you know, I think that I've, well, I don't know, maybe you guys have been speaking at more popular events, but no, I mean, I think it's pretty high right now on the public health agenda, but it's not high on the people's agenda right now. So that's an important problem, and we have to reconcile. And I think this message, guys, you can't control your behavior, you need us, right, is not a winning message. If you you know, I think when you look at what New York did, I mean, I think Roland's absolutely right. They did something that arguably may have some evidence behind it, some scientific, behavioral, psychological evidence behind it, but they basically said, you're losers, you can't make individual choices, and people felt that, right? And I'm not saying you can't actually explain this in a way that makes people understand that you're actually giving them a set of healthier choices, but that takes some work. That takes some really skilled messaging and marketing work that understands psychology. So the same psychology we use to understand why people can't make the choices has to be mobilized to figure out the message to make these things work. Now, if we don't do it, I think anyone from New York here? Right, so I've been following this thing in New York, and on one hand, I cheer the city on for being brave and actually, you know, stirring up the waters here. But when they don't go, when you don't work from popular will, there's a chance for a backlash. And New York City's Health Commission is very unique. They're an amazingly unique body because they have the same power as the city council, more or less. They can write laws. But who elected them to write laws? No, the mayor appointed them, right? The mayor appoints, so separation of powers, balance of powers, seems to have kind of gone away. And so that lack of balance of powers was there to protect us from involuntary hazards that we really all have to kind of mobilize against. And I think that if you do this, there's a chance that their powers might get taken away or curtailed. So I've been following some of the legal stuff behind it, and I'm very, I think it's something to watch, and I applaud New York for sort of going out there, but I think it's pretty treacherous stuff, if we're taking this stuff, if we're taking this stuff seriously and we want it to work, we have to take all of this, everything, very seriously. Yes, people want healthier choices. There's skepticism of business regulations, and I think I've talked several, I think I've made this point. Public has a high threshold for government protection, and there's limited support for regulations perceived to limit consumer choices. Messaging is possible. I look at the sugar tax messages, and I think the sugar tax is a great idea, but I would never call it a sugar tax. This is public health being so direct, right? I mean, why call it a sugar tax? Do we call it why not call it, this is the sports field tax? Or call it a tax for, what do we do when we put taxes on ballot initiatives? We say what we're buying, not where we're taking the money away from. So pretty simple, right? Pretty simple way that probably, and I think that, I'm not a pollster, but, I bet pollsters would say that change of messaging could create a change of heart. So, of course, there's industry opposition to regulatory strategies, but there's also industry-led voluntary initiatives. So there's something to work with here. I mean, when San Francisco did this, proposed this kind of toy ordinance, which I wrote, by the way, even though I didn't necessarily like it, I saw a lot of will on the part of industry to make amends, and whether it was ingenuous, disingenuous, it was a start. And I think that there's no fundamental conflict between healthy food and profitable food in the long run. I don't think there is, and I think I have to believe that in order to sort of move forward on this. In unintended consequences. As a regulator, I can see that anybody can game the system if they want to. And regulations are not always monitored. They're actually most often not monitored or not monitored effectively, and that's a whole separate sort of conversation. So there's a lot of things that could happen here. Meals, there could be a lot of good meal offerings, but not sold, right? The nutritional performance could provide cover for unhealthy business practices. Well, what if these were sweatshop restaurants that were serving your, perfect meals? Would you want to go there? How would we know? Right. So this is a little bit of a story of, we did menu labeling, and then this one came, and this was an ordinance. How many people know about this ordinance? You must have all followed this ordinance, right? Right. Does anyone not know about this? Okay. All right. So, San Francisco proposed a law that was written by somebody not in the city, originally proposed by somebody not in the city, didn't come from a grassroots movement, came from, a policy think tank working with, and sort of moved by anti-corporate advocates, and they proposed this law, and it said, require all children's meals should meet a certain standard, and, it could be like the school standard, where toys and incentives are given with the meals. If there were no toys and incentives, you didn't have to meet the standard. If the toy, free toys and incentives. So we wrote this law, and we saw this as good, but what we liked about it was the nutrient standards for children. We thought that could stand on its own. Require all children's meals to meet, when you market it as children's meals, meet a nutrient standard. School districts do it, so can McDonald's. Okay? Straightforward public health argument, efficacy, start nutrition, and then the market would actually have to be creative in making these things tasty and work and everything else, and it would have been swell, I think. But they mixed these two things up. They linked it together. I don't know how serious people were, but I got the sense when I was negotiating this law that the industry actually would have. If we had dropped the toys, if we had dropped the insistence of the toys, and we had said, you can have 3 years, 4 years to get here, right, they would have done this, some of the leading industry, and we would have had a child meal standard that works. So I actually think this is within reach, if done, I think, in the right way. But what happened? The law was ridiculed. We were ridiculed in the national press. The legislation passed, but it was easily undermined by the industry. How was it undermined? Anyone know? What? Charge for the toy. 10 cents of the toy, 5 cents of the toy, And they, you know, I think they probably knew that they could easily undermine it, but undermining it also gets some bad press for them that they probably didn't want. So alternatives, and I think I'm going to stop. There's a lot of things to do. Voluntary incentives and recognition programs are a way to begin to sort of put the idea of these standards out there in the world. Implementation by health philanthropies. Anyone who's funding health should do this in their cafeterias. It should be there. Anyone who's funding health should make these kind of standards part of the criteria of the meals that they serve at the conferences that they host, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, hospitals, regulatory experiments with government-controlled food. So where we're doing like the school food, we're paying for it. We're doing wherever we're paying for food, we should be able to do some version of this fairly easily. And mainstream standards first for children's meals. I think it's achievable. The public will buy into, if you're advertising a child's meal, it should meet a standard. I think that would be a really good start for somebody. So we're doing something a little bit, you know, different and really, really hard, and I'm not sure it's going to work. It's a voluntary approach. It's a little bit different because we're not leading with a voluntary, you know, the voluntary incentives programs, the healthy meal programs, some, you know, lots of them out there. In the Por Vida in San Antonio is one of the, you know, I think one. We've decided to embed health and nutrition in the idea of comprehensive sustainability. So if we're going out and working with restaurants and giving them a star, I want to give them a star because they're treating their workers well, they're sourcing their food from the right place, they're taking care of the environment, and they're safe, and they're engaging with the community. And this is a very, very hard thing to do, and we'll see if it works. These are the elements. So in conclusion, these standards are feasible. Right now, we lack a proof of efficacy and lack of political support for compulsory regulations. There's premature or overzealous regulation could damage public health reputation and credibility. Many opportunities for regulatory experiments and voluntary incentive-oriented initiatives. So thank you very much.
Okay. Any questions? Comments? Yeah. So I think the difference is that with tobacco and then later with alcohol, it was considered an addictive substance. And people were powerless under its spell. And because of the use of the word addiction, it was much easier politically to pass regulations because of, you know, exactly that concept. But we don't have that with food. I mean, we don't believe that people can't control themselves if they only wanted to. So I think that's the main difference.
Maybe just more towards strategy. I think that there are powerful market loops to capture here. You see, and so one is, well, one, the kind of obvious is that it's actually happened, right? So you've got a National Restaurant Association with a nutrition standard for their for children's meals. It's not awful, it's not the best, but it's there, right? And they're actually promoting it. Why? Because people, there is consumer demand for healthier meals. There's parental demand for healthier meals. And so I think one approach is to sort of engage in this, you know. So, it's a tightrope because how much do you engage? How much do you support an industry-led effort that you don't quite trust or you can't quite control? Public public health has to actually make that choice, and I think that it may be advantageous to work with, you know, with the industry and sort of capture this sort of public demand. The other is in the, is the health insurers and the funders, and you can already see that they're doing experiments with funding healthy food purchases, which was that you're going to hear, but just that those experiments could be extended to, so let's say there was an incentive program and some restaurants got the label and there was healthy meals, then you could get a 10% discount from your insurer for buying the, you know, the sort of the qualified meal.
Yeah, I just want to say the talk you didn't hear was about Vitality, which is doing an experiment where they gave their members a 25% discount on fruits and vegetables at supermarkets. So they had a relationship with the supermarket. This is in South Africa. And so every time they chose something that was on their list, that they could get a lower price. And they actually had a result that showed that people did increase their fruit and vegetable consumption. But so far, it doesn't look like it affected any BMI. So, yeah. I think that's a really great point. As far as the nudge of changing the placement of things, it's something that businesses would probably hate because they know that placement influences what people buy. I mean, if you look anywhere, there's always candy, like at the long line before you get to the cash register. It's an impulse buy, and if you mess with that marketing strategy, you're really going to hurt their bottom line. So. You know, you have to. One strategy might be okay with the consumer, but then it wouldn't be okay with the business.
Right. Now, I think the equity issue is really important. I think we need to look at it in each dimension. I think one we miss often is this policy efficacious? How does the efficacy differ in different socioeconomic groups? I think some of the very early work with menu labeling. Was that in terms of the choices, the lower socioeconomic groups were not benefiting from the policy. They may ultimately benefit from the industry shift, change of sort of, you know, options. In some cases, people were purchasing more. I mean, these were very early findings, but it points to the need to look at it. The other point is because the tax, you know, like a soda tax might disproportionately influence. You know, a poor person. I'm maybe a little less convinced by that argument because I think that the point, the health benefit, is also going to be disproportionately beneficial. I think we didn't talk about marketing. This was about government regulation, but I suspect that changing the sort of the choices by mandating the choices or what can be there is probably harder than. Regulating the marketing. I think marketing is maybe an in-between place to really focus strategies on banning child marketing, and it's a really good idea. And I just want to point, I mean, because my work is, something about my work is I try to do multi-objective strategies. If you ban child marketing, I know it's hard, you know, but you do it with lots of examples. There's lots of sectors, there's lots of issues that would benefit from that. So, or work towards restrictions of, and we have a precedent for restrictions of child marketing to build on.
I'd like to follow up with that question about First Amendment rights. Certainly seen that with the FDA and tobacco images. So how does that play out then in the food and nutrition area? We talk about trying to ban or restrict the market of an illegal product. How would that be any different from First Amendment rights that was happening to that?
I think that the idea of marketing to children is probably, I don't know if it's been adjudicated, as the idea that children are not in a position to be, influenced in that way. I'm not a legal scholar. Somebody else in the room who's probably been thinking about, want to comment on that? Also, you know, the Supreme Court could also change and lots of things could happen. I mean, these things have to be, look, every law was impossible once, right? And I think that, you know, every regulation was impossible once. And it may not be right. We can explore, we can experiment, we can push, we can learn, adapt, and maybe go back, you know, prohibition, back from prohibition. It's okay. I mean, I think that's okay. So I think, I don't know. Go. Anyone, any legal scholar wants to say something about that? No?
Okay. Yeah. But I guess two things, though. My impression is that children are protected. And then secondly, that commercial speech is not the same as private speech. And so I think those are two separate issues that can be
used. Some other questions? Yeah, Lenny?
I sort of say in Roland's argument, he's not here to defend himself, but, economists look at externalities, right? And there are clearly external costs of obesity. I mean, until we decide to get rid of Medicare and Medicaid and have everyone on their own for all the healthcare costs, there's externalities. And so we're all sort of in this together. And in addition, there's research that says that obesity is contagious. So we're all in this together. Obesity is contagious. There's externalities. And so I don't think we have a choice. I think Rajiv's comment about the messaging is right. And if you look at, you know, George Lakoff's work from, you know, Berkeley and stuff about how to message public health topics as we're all in this together, it's something that I don't, you know, Mayor Bloomberg probably doesn't read, but I don't know why, you know, why the messaging on the progressive side is so much worse than the messaging on the other side. That's what I want to know.
It's money.
Why are public health people so bad at messaging? Because I'm a culprit, right? I've done a lot of bad messaging in public health. I think we try to be too honest and descriptive. I mean, we just try to be like, okay, oh no, we can't say this is it because that's not it. We need to be exact. It's about, you know, like we created this indicator system. We called it the Healthy Development Measurement Tool, and now we're calling it the Sustainable Communities Index. Okay, well that's a little bit of progress over time, but we're too literate, you know, like.
Well, it's showing me George Lakoff, because he talks about our brain and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. I wrote that scientists give you what you need, and chefs or artists or whatever give you what you want.
Yeah.
So the whole issue of, course, crappy food really comes down to, you know, what do you look like and sexy and all that kind of stuff. And you really, people do want this. They want good tasty food that makes them look really great. And that's, you know, that's the message.
Yeah.
I wanted to thank both of you for your presentation, and I wish that the third panelists were here to talk about the failure of the market you brought up. But I'm wondering, how do you think the hunger problem that we have in the world comes into play here? Do you think that the obesity problem, or whatever you want to call this, needs to be focused on solely in terms of that, or do you think
I want to, Yeah, I want to take that maybe in a slightly different direction. I mean, let's not even go over the border. I think it's pretty hard to have a political conversation that balances the interests of the U.S. and the rest of the world, as we can see from climate or whatever other issue we may want to think about. And let's not even, I mean, and since we don't think and act collectively very much, that's not part of our culture right now yet, you know, or we've regressed, actually. It's pretty hard. But I think another way to look at problems, or another thing that public health needs to do, is not look at things so unidimensionally. Now, the food is treated by public health largely as an issue of nutrition, and particularly as an issue of food energy. You know, it's fairly dominant. And so our performance measures for food and interventions, is it going to change people's energy consumption? Is it going to change their weight? That's a pretty narrow way to look at food. If you look, then when we talk about solutions to that, we think about solutions that are going to change energy consumption and weight. And that's a narrow set of solutions. So I think by doing that, we're limiting the toolkit that we're using to apply to problems. And I think that's kind of the idea behind our more comprehensive social responsibility standard. But what is food? Food is, what's the health value of food? It's in the environment. It's in labor. It's in the joy we get from eating the food, right? It's in sharing. So there is lots of values of food that need to be balanced in our consideration of the health value of food, and the solutions need to be ones that go back and maximize and the health value. So we'll have these arguments too. It'll make you look good and feel sexy too, right? We can put that in our framework, and I think that's something that we need internally as an organization to be better at doing.
In my view, the problem is more at the point of purchase than far back in the system. I know a lot of people look at the whole big system, but if people weren't so attracted to this food, then there wouldn't be the demand all the way back. So in my view, the leverage point is more in the supermarket, in the restaurants, rather than the other way around. If somehow there would be a way to moderate that, then I think that's where the solution would be better.
The effective strategies are going to work at all the levels, right?
So
and the doctor should still tell the people to have a healthy diet, right? You know, I mean, so you got a pretty big army here, right? And there's enough people to work at different levels. What happens when you go up to the deeper level, what you get to the, whatever, upstream, if you want to call it, level, is you have more impacts and more issues and therefore more stakeholders. There's more people to mobilize. It's tougher, but there's more people to mobilize. So transforming subsidies, you know, U.S. farm subsidies to those that are supporting fruit and vegetable production over form, you know, there's, and in ways that are environmentally responsible, you get the NRDC and ED on board, and in ways that are protective of labor rights, you get the labor unions on board. And so it's tougher work. It may be slower work. But I think probably all those levels need to be addressed. There's interest to move at all those levels.
In the back?
Thank you.
Yeah, so you're right. So people lack insight into why they're over-consuming. I mean, people who are overweight or obese, a lot of times they'll blame themselves. But if that same person was in a different society, if they immigrate somewhere else, they'll probably have a different weight and a different diet, and they don't recognize how important the environment is in their choices. And so I think, you know, I'm sharing this not because I think that's the argument that's going to win with the general public, but it provides the rationale for the policymakers. And so, you know, if you're pitching the solution, like I think, you know, standardized portions would be an amazing solution if we could do that. And we probably could do that if there was a political will. I mean, all it takes is a measuring cup and a kitchen scale, right? So it's something that, you know, you could maybe pitch it as, well, it's just going to help people gauge how much they're eating. The same way, you know, it's easy to convince people, like, you know, we always have a standardized serving for wine, beer, and a shot of whiskey. So I don't know. I think it's going to take a lot of creative messaging to really move us in the direction that we need to go.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt that the science is correct. But, I mean, also think about this. I mean, I think I've changed my lens about public health, how I look at the world, I use the lens of human needs now. And I think of human needs in a hierarchy. And when you have human needs met, you're going to be healthier. The more human needs met, and the higher level of human needs fulfillment, healthier. So autonomy is a high level, but a core human need. So I think things that, you know, challenge your autonomy, or even challenge the perception of autonomy, are pretty countercurrent. But I think there's successful ways to. So what do we want? What's the converse of it? It's choice, right? Can we frame all this in a choice frame? I mean, probably we can. I mean, marketing people can convince you to do many things, you know, amazing things. So I think they can convince you that what we're offering in the 16-ounce cup is more choice. I was like, oh yeah, this is more choice, right? But that's part of the work we really need to do well, as we go forward.
I wanted to ask you about your concept of the stars. That a city presumably could give an establishment for different kinds of socially or health-related benefits. I think it's commonly believed that the American diet is a cheap diet, and that a healthy diet would cost more labor, more whatever. So we're going to have to push to get to the scale where a healthy diet might be less expensive and are concerned about hunger and so forth. You've got to have that in mind. From a regulatory perspective, how do you see a city council or board of health being able to impose standards on a business? Of the sort that you talked about, I know in state government we haven't even been able to get prohibitions against tobacco types of business and, you know, not doing business with, say, media companies that advertise tobacco. Or our purchasing standards of certain types for government purchasing. How do you see that?
Are you talking about, I think that's, so if you're thinking, just to make sure I think I understand what you're talking about. No, this is changing government purchasing to incentivize socially responsible industries. Is that what you're, it's government purchasing, right?
Yeah,
regulation.
Selling that as non-anti-business to those that don't want to meet that standard.
I don't know if you can sell it as, I mean, you have a choice. You can either meet the standard or and participate in the government's purchasing, be a contractor, or not meet the standard and not participate. So I think if that doesn't go, I mean, nothing really goes beyond it, because you're not controlling them. You're not telling them you must do this or you must do that. You're giving them sort of a choice. I think the way we can sell it, and this is one of the things we're going to do with our standard first, is try to get the government to say that when we're catering or something like that, we're going to go to one of these places because, okay, when you're paying somebody a living wage, which is a self-sufficiency wage, they're going to require less government services. When you're giving community benefits, your employees are working and there's a community project, that's good for the community. When there's nutrition, that's good for, you know, health. When they're safe, that's good for safety. I mean, I think they're fairly powerful arguments. I think the multiple arguments are useful because multiple arguments can capture multiple interests.
So do you foresee a sign that would be on or some kind of insignia that a company could be using to say, we are a flip?
Yeah, that's a top secret. I'll talk to you. It's a top secret project right now, and I'm very nervous about it. I'm very nervous about it because it's the hardest thing I've ever tried to do. So I can talk to you a little bit.
Okay. One last question, anybody?
Yeah. I was just going to take that argument a little bit further. So, this is for government not contractors, for purchasing food, but it's the excess argument to SNAP, right? So we're paying government money to buy. So if New York City, again as an example, tried to ban soda purchase on SNAP, there was a lot of pushback, a lot of lobbying from the industry. So it's not, I don't think it's that straightforward that you can say you can change the food and, you know, you can think that they could still participate in the SNAP program, but not just sell those stuff.
You go ahead and then I'm going to...
So that wasn't quite the same thing. So I think what he's talking about is for San Francisco city money when it's being used for, say, food that San Francisco city provides, whether it provides it like for free in its city cafeteria, I'm not sure if it does, or if city events could pay for it. But New York City was trying to put restrictions on what citizens who were recipients of a federal food program had purchased, and so that was actually New York City trying to change what federal dollars.
Right. So one of the things is it's government dollars.
So there's a very important difference. Okay. The difference is regulation that takes something away versus regulation that gives you something. I mean, so if you look at SNAP and you say, okay, I'm going to take away this, your ability to do this. That from an individual sort of choice perspective, that's going to get suspicion, you know, and concern. If you say you can do something else that we know that works, you know, New York City, we're going to match one-to-one all your fruit and vegetable purchases that you purchase the SNAP. That's pro-equity, pro-health, right? It requires, right? What?
Very expensive, but well, we
okay, expensive, okay, good, it's an idea that will work, but expensive, so then you need to find a funding source. Maybe the health insurers will, you know, the health insurers are now funding, the health insurers are giving people money for food purchases and for, for gym memberships. They might be.
The farmer's market spent $250,000 in 1 year on that program. One farmer's market.
Well, the federal government act.
It's the irrational government, right? It's totally irrational, right?
I'm talking about political feasibility. I'm talking about political feasibility. I'm not talking about you. We can all agree on like the scientific merits and the justifications. I'm talking about actually getting the stuff to work and it's different. So that's if we want to do it, I think that we should successfully try to work through through improving people's choices, especially for poor people. We should improve their choices because their lives aren't that great all the time. And they have limited choices. They have limited ability for autonomy. Autonomy is a public health need. Just as much as, you know, a healthy diet.
So I want to thank all of you because you made this session really great. We had a great discussion, and I appreciate all your comments, and thank you again for coming. Good evening.